Hello, everybody. This is Tim Green with Rattle Magazine, and this is your Rattlecast for, Tuesday, March 3rd. Thanks so much for joining us. We've got 10 people watching live and 2 likes already, which I really appreciate. If you're watching live now, please do click the like button. That always really helps with the algorithms, and, you know, we really want to appear on the, up next stuff on YouTube. You know, if you're watching a poetry video, we want the Rattlecast to show up on the watch next. And if you click the like button, that really helps. Now, today's guest is Rachel Custer, another excellent show for you lined up, and you're going to really enjoy it. But first, we like to do a bit of a warm-up poem just to get us started as everybody settles in and finds a comfortable place to sit as they watch the Rattlecast. And the poem I wanted to start with was the just-announced winner of the 2020 Neil Postman Award for Metaphor. Craig Van Ruyen's poem, Siege Machinery. Now, we started the Neil Postman Award for Metaphor way back in, what year was that? 2006, maybe? And it was really, I'll say it here, which nobody knows. It's a secret, so don't tell anybody. It's a secret just between you and me. But it was the idea of Eric Campbell, a good friend of mine and a great poet, as they say. And he loves Neil Postman, and he told me to read Amusing Ourselves to Death, Neil Postman's book about modern culture from back in the 70s. And one of the things Neil Postman says in there, he has a whole section devoted to metaphor. And he says that metaphor is an instrument of perception. And it talks about how important metaphor is. And really, metaphor is what makes poetry so important. It's the way we create new meaning out of the world. And so every year we look at the poems that we published in Rattle, and we find the one that exhibited the best use of metaphor, whether it's extended metaphor or just little great metaphors throughout the poem. We have 14 winners so far, and if you haven't read them all, I really encourage you to go back on our Neil Postman Award page and look at the past winners, because they're all such great poems. And this year it was Craig Van Ruyen, and I want to share his poem to start out. This is poem Siege Machinery. And let's see, here it is.
Siege Machinery. Dusk slides beneath her dress, creeps across her thighs, slips over the rise of her belly. Night gathers in the hollow at the base of her throat. I know she hears knives sharpening when I unzip her, the dress down fountaining over her bare feet. I can vanish into the dark small of her back, my bristled chin plowing down its single row. But there are places I dare not touch. The tympani behind a knee, the bowstring throat, a taut and fluted ankle, each an old crime scene, still taped off. Yet she has learned to open, guiding the hot blades of my hands into untouched places that burn with their own furnaces. I don't pretend to be a healer, bring only my glinting hook of need to peddle open her ribs, crack through the gristle of her assembled face. She is a horse, gravid with the bodies of old lovers. With them, I move inside her, waiting to set the city on fire.
That was Craig Van Ruyen reading his poem Siege Machinery, which was the winner of the 2020 Neil Postman Award for Metaphor. If you would like to submit to the Neil Postman Award for Metaphor, all you have to do is send a submission to Rattle. Any of our free categories, we consider everything for the Neil Postman Award. It is just, we look through at everything we published over the last year. Sometimes it's Poets Respond. Sometimes it's the Ekphrastic Challenge. More often than not, it's the print issue. But we look back at whatever we've published and find the best use of metaphor that we found throughout the whole previous year. And we felt that was Siege Machinery from Craig Van Ruyen. Craig Van Ruyen is a judge in the Superior Court of San Luis Obispo County. He has a BA in journalism and a JD from UCLA and an MFA from Pacific University. He was also winner of the 2014 Rattle Poetry Prize. So he's one of those poets that we really admire at Rattle, who has a different job that has nothing to do with poetry whatsoever, and still, as a part-time passion, writes really great poems. He hasn't had a book published yet, and he really needs to, because he writes great poems. That's Craig Van Ruyen. You can't find him anywhere on the internet except for the few places he's been published. He publishes frequently in Rattle, though, so check out Rattle and look up Craig Van Ruyen. Now, today's poet is Rachel Custer. She's appeared in 3 issues of Rattle and 3 times in Poets Respond, most famously with How I'm Like Donald Trump, which is, I think, I can't remember, it's like the 7th most read poem in Rattle's history. It's the most read poem from Poets Respond. She's the author of The Temple She Became from Five Oaks Press. She's also the recipient of a 2019 NEA Fellowship in Poetry. She's published poetry all over. She lives in Indiana, and her work is constantly informed by the wrestles with the values and struggles of the rural Rust Belt. Her Christian faith is vital to her understanding of the world and her art. And here she is, Rachel Custer. And don't forget to unmute yourself, Rachel.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. Yeah. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. So glad to see you finally. You know, we published you. I still remember the day. It's sort of a day that lives in infamy or something.
Yeah. Where I remember it too.
I made a post on my own Facebook page, just my personal Facebook account, and said, you know, we've received, it was right before the 2016 election. And I made a post and said, you know, I've read, we've published, like, you know, I've read 5,000 poems hating on Donald Trump. And you know, we published maybe like 5 or 10 of them or something. And I really would love to see like one poem that, like, you know, felt compassion for Donald Trump in some way or something like that. And I remember you left a comment. I had no idea who you were. And you said, I'm on it.
And I
just thought, like, well, yeah, whatever. And then it ended up being a great poem. And so we published
Thank
it.
You.
And then,
Thank
you know, you. Stuff happened and whatever. But it's really cool to see you. And yeah, so and you're in Indiana.
It is. It's good to kind of meet, right? The way we meet now.
It really is, yeah. So do you want to start us out with a poem, like any poem of your choice? I have your poem just sent me here on file. And one thing I have to say, usually I show the book on the document cam, but I read your book like a year ago, and I lost it.
Okay.
I don't know where the heck it is.
Thank you.
So,
but you lost it.
I really enjoyed it, but Amazing. I, for the life of me, I can't find it. So so we're going to do the whole thing over document cam, but I'll show it right now. This is The Temple She Became. A beautiful cover. I can't remember who the artist is, and since I don't have the book, I can't flip.
Naoko Fujimoto.
Yeah. Fujimoto. Yeah. Beautiful art. The Temple She Became from Five Oaks Press. It's your book from a couple years ago, but I think most of the poems you sent are newer poems, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Most of the ones that you've seen, probably.
So, so start with something, whatever you want.
Okay. I think I'm going to start with a poem called Song.
Okay.
Let me find it here. I'm not in order of anything. And this is, I mean, representative of me. Okay. So it's just called Song.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm trying not to explain as much. Song. A woman alone in the boat of a man. A woman, a moan in the throat of a man. Brief stone afloat in the moat of a man. Secret sewn into the coat of a man. Note a man, how he struts down the road of a girl. How his rough voice cuts the ode of a girl. What she owed, not the world he's made of her fear. Not the shade of him here where she's paid with her tears. In the game, so she thinks as she drinks one more beer. Yes, but think we'll pay the child, praise for that child, the one. The knees is a cry for a life where to live will mean more than to die. Goodbye is the bone in the throat of her now, a huge stone sinking the boat of her now. While she stands in the bow, child in hand, singing the last mournful note of her now.
And that was Rachel Custer reading Song, a newer poem. So if you have any questions for Rachel, feel free to leave them in the comment window on Skype. I'm watching, and I'll pass any comments or questions you have for Rachel along. So Rachel, one of the things that I just find so interesting about you, you publish a bunch of essays back in, I think last year, maybe a year and a half ago, about poetry and spirituality. And you mentioned your Christian faith a lot in your bios and whatnot. Can you talk a little bit about what poetry is to you and how it relates to your faith? Because, you know, poetry to me is a spiritual act, even though I'm sort of a secular humanist or secular transhumanist or something.
I'm losing you.
You're losing me? I'm not sure.
Yeah, you're cutting kind of in and out.
Well, your sound is fine for us, so kind of, I don't know. What I wanted to ask you about is your relationship between poetry and faith for you. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can't hear you.
We can hear you fine. You're good.
You can hear me?
I can hear you, yeah.
You keep cutting out for me.
Do you want to switch your headphones to the other ones you had? Is that, that could be it, because your audio's fine for me.
Okay. As long as I can hear you and what you're asking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're good. You're good. So just, I'm asking about the relationship between poetry and faith for you, because you wrote a bunch of essays for Ojal that are really interesting to me. So what do you think about...
For Ojal, yeah.
Yeah, so what do you think about poetry and faith? Like,
gotcha,
how is it
sorry.
A... Yeah, no problem.
Well, that's evolved. That's been an evolving thing for me. But I am a Christian. And I think for me, the way that I understand God is primarily, or maybe not primarily, but in a large sense, as a creator, right? As a creative God. It's the first thing that we find out about God in Scripture. In the beginning, God created is the fifth. It's the fifth word of Scripture, right? The first attribute we know about God is that he makes. And of course, our relationship to God is that we are his creation. And so I see God as an artist, right? The first artist. And what we know about how from Scripture about how he creates human beings is that he creates us in his image, in the same way that a sculptor, right, makes, you know, it makes the statue of David in his image. And so creative, the expression of creativity as fundamentally something that we do naturally to kind of emulate and interact with the God who created us.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that it's a spiritual practice, right? To create. You were talking about metaphor, and I think about Christ in the Scripture, and the fact that a lot of the way that he shared spiritual principles was through parables and stories, right? And a lot of the Old Testament is written. Is poetry, or proverbs, you know, the kind of similar to like the Zen koan. Is that how you say that? Literature, and metaphor is necessary. It's a spiritual practice. It's the only way we can understand something that is beyond, fundamentally beyond our understanding. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Is to say what it's like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yesterday we were talking, or I was talking to you, and if you noticed on the screen, if you're watching live, it said Paul E. Nelson underneath Rachel Cusler for a minute, because I forgot to update it. But I did the interview with Paul E. Nelson over Skype for issue number 68, which is coming up in the summer. And we talked a lot about poetry as a spiritual journey, as a sort of prayer, and a way to...
Yeah.
Connect with the broader nature of reality that we can't really access. And that's really what I'm most interested in when it comes to poetry. And I don't know, it's just really interesting to me. I find the idea of Christian faith a lot more interesting recently. So I'm really interested to hear what you have to say about that. Now, let's see, on the chat window... So Leslie Herbert says, I'm hoping you will read from your Flatback Sally poems. You know what? What are the Flatback Sally poems?
Oh, so this is a new thing. I've been writing a few. So what I've been doing instead of publishing lately, because it just seemed so overwhelming to me to think about all the things that needed to be done to share poetry after I write the poetry. And it was getting to a point where it was feeling like I was finding a hard time to love writing the poetry. So I've just been kind of sending them out by email
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
because I fundamentally dislike the idea of, in a way, of commodifying, but also not commodify, I guess, of this the poetry community that we've created, this online quick turnaround kind of thing. I like some of it. I like engaging in it to some extent, but I also just liked writing poems before I ever knew about that, right? So I just like to share the poems sometimes, and I think that's, for me, the important, that's one way that I'm trying to get back to just loving writing poetry. So anyway, I have this mailing list that I kind of send poems out to, and the Flatback Sally poems are kind of a recent. I started writing some of these kind of Rust Belt narrative voice poems, with the before I got the NEA. And Flatback Sally is kind of this, I don't know, this woman that I've created and written about and through, and I've written a few of them now, and everybody seems to really like her and like the poems. So, she's a mythologized me, maybe. I don't know. I guess maybe all of our people are, but she's a sinner.
Do you have any of her of the Flatback Sally poems among what you sent?
I do. Do you want me to? Let's see.
I
I
see
have.
Flatback Sally dreams of an escape. Do you want to maybe read that?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll grab that one. Have it in here somewhere. And then I have the old man warns the young man at the bar. So, you want me to go ahead and read Flatback Sally's
Yeah,
Dreams of an
why don't you do
Escape?
that?
Okay. Flatback Sally, Dreams of an Escape. Sally burns like a fever through the night. Listen, she can spin a tall tale just like a knife, sock it into your chest from 30 yards. Deadly as some silences, that one is. Keeps secrets tucked against white thighs. Money clip fat with little lies, half-truths, all the world knows of you. Listen, she is purring. Draw me closer, castle me. I can be just as loyal as royalty. Switch. Mercy runs like nighttime through the fever of a boy. Listen, she will spin a tale. Of good intentions, she knows just enough to be dangerous. Of danger, she knows the pretty house he keeps, light singing a window hymn. Where Sally goes, mercy follows. A little girl is a certain light, catching the wrong eye, keening through the desert toward promised land. Mercy knows she's not hard enough to cross that final river. Faith, a blade tucked inside her hand. There's Flatback Sally.
Do you want
She's a problem.
do you want to read? You said you had two. Do you want to read the other one?
I do, yes. The old man warns the young
Okay, yeah, I
man at
got
the
that up too.
bar. Okay. Flatback Sally, come a whole new woman once that sun go down. Run over this little town just like a glance. Careful, young man, she might just fall on you. Be careful how you do. That girl's all mouth and swallows and swears. Hell burnt the bottom of her throat. Bears silence well, but that don't mean she hears. Listen, Flatback Sally got nothing no man needs. Let a woman be your vessel. Sally bleeds for men to stop her spilling. You should know when girls like Sally bleed, it's all for show. What smile she shows, there's twice that grimace hid. Her porch light eyes like lures. Believe me, kid, Sally may look pretty there beneath you on her back, like moonlight on steel teeth, a new laid trap.
Yeah, and that was The Old Man Warns the Young Man at the Bar, one of the Flatback Sally poems.
Yes.
One of the things, you know, we published you in the Rust Belt Poets issue. And one of the things one of the essays I think I read, maybe
Yes.
Ojal, you talked about wanting to represent stories from, you know, different places that don't usually get represented. And you say small towns are made of stories. And a person might as well be the stories people tell about her, which I thought was a really interesting way to
Yeah.
talk about small towns and stuff. You grew up in rural Indiana. right? So what are you trying to do as far as representing that culture in the rural middle America, I guess you could say.
Well, I think that the culture in a lot of ways is constantly talked about, right? And in ways that gloss over the true, the reality of it, and the in ways that kind of dehumanize and kind of distance. And so I'm interested in troubling that narrative, I think. Always and in humanizing and in bridging maybe some of the beliefs that are held with some of the realities, but also in mythologizing and in my own way and in our own way, you know, troubling it.
Yeah,
Complicating the narrative.
troubling narratives is a really great sort of, I never, heard it put that way before, but it's a great way to say what poetry does, you have a cat now. Hello,
Yeah.
cat.
I hope so. Yeah, I know. My cat's like crazy. I think so, and I hope so, because I think that it's really easy to simplify and dehumanize and distance, especially with social media. You know, it's so easy for us to dehumanize each other and respond to one another as if we're brands, right? Or as if we're accounts or whatever, you know, icons. And I think that's so uninteresting. It's just not what I want to do with poetry or with words, you know. That you can do with
Yeah,
marketing.
it always seems to me like poetry's job is to expand human consciousness and to sort of make order out of the chaos and the interstices of our lives that we don't fully understand. And so disrupting narratives is the job of the poet, like you have this map of the world and what poetry really does, or what really art does, is break apart that old map and say, hey, you're missing like whole things here that you didn't see clearly. And I think that's why, art is such a tough sell. Like you mentioned marketing, and art doesn't sell the way commodities within popular culture do. And it's because it's disruptive rather than confirming. So it's interesting to hear you put it that way.
Well, I think order out of chaos, yes, but also chaos out of order. In some ways, right? Because if you think about like a glossy magazine, they're perfectly ordered, right? They always have the same style, the same. We have even now we have genres of writing that are like search engine optimization, right? And so that's order, but it's not truth. So in some way, sometimes truth can be like, you know, I think you can break that apart and that's where you find truth. And I do, I mean, so I don't know. I think you're right. It has to be something, I don't know, something with a twist, right? Or what is it? It just seems like more
Yeah,
marketing to
well,
me.
Kate Hanson Foster says that was the best thing about the Trump poem. And that's what I agree completely. It was just something that we hadn't heard. It was a different perspective. And so many people appreciated that. Because that's what art's job is to break up what you think you know, and to just break up new ground. Do you want to read a couple more?
I think so. Sure. Has anybody asked for anything specific
No,
or
no. So whatever you want to do is totally good.
so I want to go let's see. Yeah, I think I'll do a poem called Consider the Trigger. Moxie, get out here. Consider the trigger, the difference between winter and winter without, that deep freezer humming like a beast. What hunger sleeps in your belly, cave? What fear? This end of year is colder than the last, this fast approaching fast, these short days long. We can't afford to eat if killing's wrong. Consider this a warning shot, or not. Our children are not trees to take their life from light, and anyway, there's almost none. This meat, our sun, this lifeblood you disdain, this loss of life, our living's gain. Meat for bones and straining backs, double shifts and chopped wood stacks. Meat for making all we do, meat for shipping it to you.
That was another new poem.
I think.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. I think a lot of what I want to do with the newer poems that I'm writing, a lot about kind of the people here and the narratives that I've seen about the people mm-hmm. here where I live and where I've lived, is to both bridge the difference between them, but also to maybe implicate. I don't know how to say that. Implicate people in community, if that makes any sense. I think it's boring and easy to suggest that there are all these bad people over here, or all these X people or Y people, without considering what is it that you do to contribute to perhaps the reasons for their lifestyle, right? The reasons for the way they live. I don't know.
Yeah, it's something that always troubles me, just the way, like, I hated that deplorables line that Hillary Clinton had. Just writing off a whole segment of the country. I live in a town, it's a small town near a military base, so there are a lot of military people here. And, you know, they're the deplorables, really. And I play softball and poker with them, and they're good people that have good kids and care about, you know, they're not racist, sexist, xenophobes, you know? And so it is troubling the way that we do that. And they do that too, you know, like, liberals or libtards. It's a way that we just have these tribes of, you know, and social media with its echo chambers and the way we silo each other. It's so easy to paint other people as caricatures that think differently than we do. Yeah. But for the most part, we have the same values. And
right.
And there's really not a lot of exploring that conservative side of our American culture through poetry, because there are just so few conservative poets. Do you have any idea why that is? Like, why are there so few conservative poets?
Yeah, well, I have some. There may be more conservative poets than people know, but either they don't talk about the fact that they're conservative or they aren't published. Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, I have a lot of places that won't publish me, they've said it straight out. So it's not, that's fine. They, you know, that's their magazine or whatever. And that's what they do. That's cool. But, you know, I think that a lot of the issues that we've seen, the struggles, the reason that people were shocked that Donald Trump won is because they were in an echo chamber where they didn't understand that the vast, mostly silent middle of the country doesn't necessarily talk a lot about what they believe or what they do. They just do it. So they don't necessarily, or haven't up till now, I think this is changing, don't necessarily get on Twitter or get, you know, and they just go and vote in droves, in absolute droves. So, and when we're all locked in our echo chambers, you know, it can be very shocking to learn that there are people who think the opposite, the exact opposite of what you think, you know, and that's something I think we've all kind of been dealing with since the election. Is it feels almost like there are two worlds, right? If you try to get outside of that at all. And that you're constantly being pushed to one extreme or the other. And I think you're right. The the majority of us are somewhere there in the middle, want to be.
Yeah. Well, I don't even know if that's the case, though. It's just a troubling thing to me is that it seems like we just get more and more locked into our one mode of thinking. And you know, like you unfriend or like there's trend, you know, they divorce somebody if they vote for the wrong person or whatever, you know, I mean, that just, you know, we have to have dialogue and a bridge for that gap so we can talk to each other. Do you want to kick that cat out and I'll put it on my screen if you want to get up for a second. Well, it's just a little, like she keeps walking over the microphone. Yeah. Well, I have a dog. We have a German Shepherd, and he comes in while I do the critique of the week all the time, and starts scratching himself and stuff. So it's the same kind of thing. It's just life, which is a cool thing about doing these shows and showing poets in their actual environment. Like it's not like the AWP conference where everybody.
In my environment.
There's like a nature documentary for poets every time. But we all have cats and dogs and stuff, and it's cool to see. Do you want to talk a little bit?
And mine are crazy.
Are they? Do you want to talk a little bit about the experience of publishing that poem and what happened on social media? Like how did it feel to you? It was a very strange experience to me publishing that poem now 3 years or two and three and a, how many years ago? Yeah, 3.5 years ago, and it has been a while. And I still think it's a great poem. If anybody hasn't read it, it's How I'm Like Donald Trump, and it really it could have won the Neil Postman Award for metaphor. It was one actually it was in the running. It's a great extended metaphor for Trump is the Grand Canyon. What? The biggest empty space to be filled. I think it's just a great way to characterize that sort of aspect of humanity. It got beat out, I think, by Kelly Grace Thomas last week's guest. I think it was like among the two poems we were considering actually, and she just like ripped off the metaphors and you had
That's
one
really
extended
cool.
metaphor. So it's kind of like yeah, I remember contemplating that. But what was the experience like? Because it was really strange for me because the first like. 6 hours after we published that poem, I got a huge response of people who really appreciated it. And, you know, cause we'd sort of had Trump, I always call it the 2 minutes hate where, you know, it's like 1984 where we just stare at the Trump figure as someone to detest and, you know, and he's detestable in a lot of ways. So, but then to have that turned around and have him be viewed through a lens of empathy to sort of what he goes through psychologically, I guess you could say. A lot of people really wrote in and said they appreciated the poem so much, and it was great to have fresh poems. And that was like the first 8 hours, and then I don't know. After it sort of hit social media or hit Twitter, and so then all of a sudden I started getting all this hate mail about how you know I should be hung from a tree and you know and fired and you should die and everybody should die because everybody should always die. That's kind of how it felt for the next 12 hours after the first eight. And that was my experience, but what was that experience like for you? And do you regret it all? Like, do you, cause I think that was right. I don't know if it was before, if you had like issues before on Twitter or if that was the start of it, but, do you regret publishing that poem is another question I've always wondered.
No, I don't regret it. I'd do it again tomorrow. I think that first of all, people who kill art are contemptuous. I have no respect for them. And I mean, you know, because of what I believe about what art is and what our creativity is and what our creative process is, I don't care. I just don't think of them as moral or ethical in any way. I have strong feelings about that. I will say though, there was previous to the Donald Trump, you know, I was fairly new to both being online and especially the online poetry community. I had started an AW joined the Bind poetry group.
Hey,
right?
Hey, cut out for a little bit. Can you step back? You started at AWP, and then we cut out a little bit.
Okay. I was brand new kind of to the poetry scene or whatever, and had written for a long time, but never knew that there was like a poet, like living poets that wrote. And so at the AWP mentor, the mentor to mentor program, and joined as part of that, or from downstream from that, I learned about the Binders poetry group.
And that's Binders Full of Women Poets, which for people who don't know, just for the background, that's a group. I think Mitt Romney said back in 2012, when he was running against Obama, he said that he had binders full of women or something like that. And so you know, as a response, women, a really, really wonderful thing. Women got together and started networking through these binders. And one of them, you know, there are all sorts of different kinds of careers and jobs and stuff. But people started networking through many things. And one of them was poetry. So there's this binder full of women poets. So that's the background to this.
Yeah. It could have been a wonderful thing. And I'm sure for many people it was. It was extremely horrible for me. First of all, the Binders group was predicated on a worldview that was entirely inconsistent with the worldview that I had ever held. A lot of the stuff, the way that they talk, the lingo and stuff, I'd never really, I mean, I'd read literary critical theory and all that, but it was like critical church, right? Like, I transgressed. So, I mean, fundamentally, I did not, because we fundamentally held different worldviews, people thought the worst of me. And I just kind of rolled downhill from there. So that started. And yes, I do think there were real positives for a lot of women with those groups. The negative thing was that then they become a very powerful place from which to kill people's work. And I think there have been men that have experienced that, and there have been women that have experienced that. I think the deep, deep irony is that the people who seem to have it experience it the most is the people to whom they claim to be allies, right? So people who are already in these groups that they claim are marginalized, they're the ones who get harmed, right? And then maybe the white men kind of fail up. I mean, you know, not to join in that thing, but really, I mean, they go on and they publish with whatever and whoever, and yet there are people of color, or there are, you know, gay people or whatever that are working class, and they just kind of, who knows, maybe they stop writing. Maybe that's why they don't have any conservative poets.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
So I think, I mean, that's real. That's a real thing.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like it's a little cultish, to be honest. And, you know, it seems like you know, if you're in a cult, like if you think about like Scientology, and we'll probably get like attacked for just talking about Scientology.
Yeah.
But if you imagine Scientology, like they go after more than anybody, they go after people who used to be Scientologists and then sort of have transgressed in some way, because that's a way, it's not really a way to change the culture. It's a way to keep people in line within the cult and to be feared of being apostate, you know? And, so going after somebody who's in the binders, and it's not just you, you know, I've heard from so many people that, that the binders is a really toxic, place, you know, for anybody who deviates whatsoever from the party line. And it's just a way to enforce groupthink, it seems to me.
Well, you have to even join it. You have to. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, how has, you know, you mentioned that now you publish directly just by emailing people and don't really participate as much in the literary community. How is that? I don't know. How does that feel? Like, how is that? What's that been like for the last, I don't know, year or so?
Hard in some ways and disappointing in some others, but also in a way kind of freeing. I think that I kind of did not, I mean, there was a lot of stuff that I was having personally that happened that just made things really bad. And then I just kind of engaged and kind of sent things over the cliff. You know what I mean? There were a lot of personal, my daughter was sick and, I was drinking a lot. So, there was a lot of stuff that ways that I engaged that I didn't necessarily know any better of how to, I don't know, how to handle it. But with that, and so now I think it's very, very difficult. It was very difficult for a while for me to find, almost find the love I had for poetry again. With the toxicity of the environment in general. And so because that toxicity, I think, is rooted a lot in the online community, right? And just got off of it. I just let it go. And I think that was important. It was freeing for me to just say, I just want to share my work. I just want to write poems and share poems and read poems. And, I'd be lying if I said that I didn't want to be published in all the cool mags and, have all the cool people retweeting my poems and reading my poems and saying how great they are. But is that real anyway? The real thing is where someone reads your line alone in a room somewhere and it means something to them that they never knew before, or, connects you to them, or that's what I think. So I'm kind of thankful in a way. And no, I wouldn't change anything about that, about the Trump poem. I think it was important to write it. I almost think that sometimes when you need to write a poem, you almost have, it's kind of almost received, almost kind of channeled in a way, not channeled in the spirit, but almost like a received wisdom or a shared larger thing than just you or your thoughts. And that poem, I really felt like it was. I wrote it in about 20 minutes, so it just came.
Do you have that poem like in front of you?
I can get
Yeah,
it up.
do you
You
want to
want me
read it?
to?
Just because we've talked about it
Pull
for
it
like
up
so
here.
much that we probably should read it so people know what we're talking about. If you don't mind pulling it up.
Yes, I will find it.
So this was published in
Yeah.
October like 26th maybe of 2016, right before the election. Yeah, this was after we'd
Yeah,
published.
I mean, the hate I got from that.
The hate I got too.
It was
Yeah, it really
wild.
was. It was sort of just unhinged, frankly. Like as if publishing a poem that sort of
Was,
tries
yeah.
to imagine, having empathy for Donald Trump as somehow that was going to swing the election. Like a poem could swing the election. Somebody said, "Are you?" After he won, somebody wrote an email and said, "Are you happy now that you got Trump elected by publishing that disgusting poem?"
Wow.
So let's hear that disgusting poem because I think people probably want to listen
So,
to it.
well, and so the reason I brought up the binders in the first place was because then, of course, when that thing comes out, when you see all these outrage groups coming out, it's already been talked about and ginned up in that group, right? Or in groups like it, where it's like, oh, did you guys see this problematic person or this problematic journal or whatever? That's always the word they use. Then they go off on a big, huge, like, hate fest. And then they hit Twitter and Facebook, and it looks very much like you have a mob who all these people think this thing, right? Except they've already been thinking this thing together behind the scenes. So,
Yeah, I'm
anyway,
always reminded of
this is called How I Am
just
Like
say I'm
Donald.
always reminded of there was in a fourth grade I grew up in upstate New York, and there was this story that my fourth grade history
Yeah.
teacher talked about how when the British were going to come up the Hudson River to invade New York, there was an island. And there were six troops or something stationed on this island, and to make the British ship that was coming up, think that there was a whole bunch of troops there. He had the general of these like little brigade of like 6 or 8 people, had them walk just in a row in and out of the tree line over and over again to make it look like it was a huge army. And that's kind of how this stuff on Twitter goes. It's like the same.
Right, they circle.
They
back
do.
Around,
it's the same,
right?
Like 50 people, and they make it feel like it's, you know, 5,000 or something. But it's 50 people who are just, you know, have a certain worldview that, you know, and they genuinely believe their worldview. But it's a very closed-minded, one-dimensional worldview, pretty much. So anyway, let's hear the poem. How am I like Donald Trump? And I think I can put it up on screen too.
Okay, how I am like Donald Trump. For DT and other lonely people. Yesterday, I said the thing I was trying to say perfectly to myself. I am something astounding. I am like the Grand Canyon, I said, by which I meant I sometimes feel hedged in by those who would sweat in hot cars for days just to stand and look at me. And people think I am saying I am a spectacle, a wonder, surrounded by nothing as huge as me. And people think I am claiming majesty. People travel for days to look at the most important canyon, which is to say, the biggest empty space. Sometimes I might as well kick pea gravel over the side rather than try to explain who I am and wait until I hear it hit the ground. What I am trying to say in small, hard words that always fall away from what I mean is I am not the canyon, the immense perfection of its depth. I am more the missing earth dispersed, trying to feel whole, to believe that God makes sometimes by taking away.
Yeah, and that's so how I'm like Donald Trump by Rachel Custer from October 18th, 2016, right before the election. And the poem to me, I don't know what it means to you, because, you know, really when you tap into something sort of deep, it means a lot of things to a lot of people. But to me, it's a poem about narcissism and that empty, like we published a bunch of poems that were critical of Trump, right? But really what it is an extended metaphor that really explains the problem with narcissism. Like there's this empty space that desperately needs to be filled. And it's a hollowness. And and of all the sort of like think pieces and opinion pieces in the New York Times and whatever about Trump's sort of issues that he has, this poem more than anything illuminated the you know, him as a human being who struggles with something which we all struggle with maybe as a result of, but who struggles with something serious and is a real human being with flaws and like the rest of us. So I don't know what the poem means to you though. So I'm curious kind of to what you were thinking about when you wrote it.
Well, it was one thing that I've seen, I guess, that I've seen from through all of this is I've realized how my worldview shapes the way that I see things in ways that I don't necessarily know is different from the way other people see things. Because of probably the same, you know, the echo chambers that I have set up, just by nature of living here. And, you know, so there's an idea in my faith, in Christianity, called original sin. And the idea is that we are all, at least in the Christianity, as I understand it, is that we are all inherently sinful, inherently unable to be holy, right? Holy enough to earn our way to God. We need grace. We need redemption. And so how, when I wanted to be empathic, when I wanted to try to write a poem, and that was the challenge kind of, was to write a poem that wasn't, I was seeing all these poems come across that were just like, you know, bludgeoning on them again and again and again. And I get that people could, that's valid to write about, but I wanted to try something different. I thought, you know, what about all these people? There are millions of people who think he's quite, you know, he's a valid candidate. He's not all these things. And so I just thought it is not that far of a leap from thinking, from understanding that we are all inherently sinfully lost and saying, I am like this person who is horrible in some way. Right. And so I just thought, how am I like him? And in that way, I can be, I'm sure, I felt at the time, I very much empathized with this whole, the main visual that I got of him, which was angry crowds surrounding what looked like just a lonely man to me in a lot of ways. So, and I felt that way. I felt alone and I felt sad and empty. And I, at my worst, I'm sure that I can be narcissistic and angry and hateful. So that
It
was it.
the epigram is for Donald Trump and other lonely people, and that really fits, because I think that kind of fundamentally is what, I mean, that's what narcissism is, not having a sense of being loved, and so having that hole that can never be filled. And I think that's what, I mean, not to armchair shrink Trump or anybody that I've never, analyzed directly, but that's kind of, it feels like that's what it is a sense of loneliness, like that can never be filled. But it's interesting that you talk about original sin, because I've always felt like, even as an atheist, I think the one thing that we're missing the most in society, maybe, after God is dead and we don't really have religion as the fundamental sort of center of society anymore, we really don't. But what we really miss the most is the concept of original sin, because the idea that everybody is flawed and struggling and fails constantly, is such an important central thing to realize, and you can't have forgiveness without that realization that everybody's flawed and everybody has problems and we're all doing our best in the way, with the cards we've been given. And I don't know, I just think that's such an important, there are a whole bunch of concepts that I feel like we're lost and missing from Christianity, and that's one of the main ones.
And I think that that's the problem. If we want to talk about the woke worldview, right? This is the problem with the worldview that I confronted in with the binders or with the on Twitter or whatever. The worldview that that says do better, right? Do better. The understanding, and that's I think that's what notion in that worldview. You're either in or you're a monster, right? It's a black and white thing. You're either okay or you're problematic because it is rooted in a belief that people can fundamentally be good, right? So when I say that the worldview that I hold is absolutely diametrically opposed to everything that poetry is right now, or that maybe the humanist idea of that people are fundamentally good or can ever be fundamentally good, it's as opposed as it can be. And I would make the case that exactly what you said, you can only have redemption if you recognize that you're a sinner, right? I don't know how any poet can see the history of literature and not realize that we are all broken, right? We're all fun. So I don't know of any perfect poet or writer that I've ever read. And so the problem is, I guess I would say I have, oh dear, are you
Oh,
there
yeah, I'm here.
still? Okay, sorry. So I guess what I would say is that I had a little bit of a jump start on that whole idea of being able to identify with someone who was had the that some was monstrous in some people's eyes, right? Because I have the capability to be a person who needs redemption, like we all do, I think.
I think so. Another thing that I think you said at some point, that I really found interesting, again, as a secular sort of evolutionary biology atheist kind of person, you talked about that the social mobbing as a manifestation of Satan. And I actually completely agree, without having the religious background or cosmology to back that up. But my opinion of it is that mobbing behavior is the sort of neurological construct or the neurological program that Satan was built to represent, which was this sense of intense tribalism and hatred of the outgroup, and the way that we, you know, just stoning people. Like, stoning people is Satan, you know? And right. and so, so right. social media, like Twitter behavior, where everybody piles on, and it's the dissolution of self toward the, a destructive othering, I guess. And I really feel like that is the... is yeah. the human trait, which came through biology. You know, for 200,000 years, humans were in a small tribe of maybe 150 or 200 people. And if you saw somebody who wasn't in your tribe, they were a deadly, like, existential threat to you and your tribe, right? And right. so any other was this right. sort of, you know, evil that you needed to destroy before they destroyed mm-hmm. you. And I think that was the history of the human race. And so we have this, like, programming in there to see the other, to see the deplorables as somebody who, you know, we need to pile on and destroy. And I feel like that is the sort of the, I don't know, like the evolutionary technology or something that Christianity created, was this concept of Satan as a construct to represent that tendency in human behavior. And so when you, so and you've said that Twitter mobbing feels like Satan to you. So
evil,
yeah,
right?
Evil. Like, that's what it feels like. I think that's what evil is yeah. intentionally trying to destroy the outgroup. Even if you're, you know, claiming yeah. to be inclusive, trying to destroy the outgroup is like the heart of what evil really is. And yeah. So can you say anything right. about what your feelings about that are?
Well, I think. You know, it makes me think of, like, the part in the Bible where the woman is getting ready to be stoned for adultery, right? The man is nowhere to be seen, of course, but they're going to stone the woman. And Jesus says famously, right, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. So what you lose when you lose the concept that none of us are without sin is that everybody is perfectly willing to start throwing stones. And so I think also the other thing about social media is that it tricks us into thinking that we are only saying our opinion or we are one voice. Right. But when you're on the other side of it and you have 1,000 people, right. Or even 50, as you said, making a comment, it feels very much like an existential threat to mm-hmm. you. Right. And then so then in some ways you respond in a way that's out of fear. Right.
Yeah,
out of almost
yeah.
that abject fear of being backed in.
Yeah, I feel like you're kind of cutting out a little bit. So I'll talk over you for a second and hopefully it'll come back. But
OK.
But yeah, I feel like it's it triggers this reflex, which is like drowning. I think it's like a drowning mm-hmm. type reflex where,
yeah.
you know, being cast out of the tribe when
Absolutely.
We were hunter-gatherers on the savannah for 150,000, 200,000 years, being cast out right. of the tribe was a death sentence. So what this social media does is hijack that
right.
neurological circuit, and it makes you desperate mm-hmm. to fit back in with the tribe. And so you're saying, like, please don't kill me. Like, and that's the sense,
right.
you know, the emotional, sociological
right.
sense that we're
right.
experiencing when you're mobbed. And, you know, and both you and I are people who've gone through it.
Right.
And it is really hell. Like, it's not fun at all. Like, you can pretend that you don't
yeah.
care.
It is.
Yeah, you can
it's
pretend
horrible.
That you don't care.
Yeah.
And that it really hurts,
it hurts.
Bad.
It hurts,
know?
Yeah.
And that's just the truth of it. And it changes you forever, I think. For me,
it does. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
Yeah. And it's really, you know, like Don Cher is gone from Twitter. You know, everybody's sort of backing away and it creates this sort of sense of just dread, I think. And it's really unproductive and not participating in poetry in the way that's positive and, you know, transcendent that we should be. So that's what it is. So we've been.
Well, I don't think you can. It creates an environment in which it's impossible because to trouble the narrative, you have to be willing to tell the hard truth, right? You have to be willing to say the truth about what you see in the world or in yourself, even, that's horrifying, right? The monstrous that you see within yourself or the world, or even just the daily, the kind of banality of evil, right? And right now, everyone is so busy trying to stay on the right side of the mob that we're not saying anything interesting. Unless you're someone who kind of has reached a level of being kind of unimpeachable, and I'm not sure that there are as many people there as think they are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, everybody has original sin. I think that's just the truth of human nature. Now, we've talked about this subject. Like, I kind of wanted to put like a little bit of this talk at the end to not trample your poetry, and we kind of did that. Actually, we accidentally like started talking about it and then got caught away. So let's extend this show a little bit.
That's all right.
No, let's extend the show a little bit, and let's get back into some poems and talk about poetry a little bit before we wrap up. So maybe read like a poem or two, and then we'll ask a question about a poem, and then we'll do a couple more poems, and then we'll be done.
Okay, I'm going to read a poem called from my book called Because of You, Bearded. When we were seven, I dropped a doll from the hayloft, the porcelain girl with eyes like yesterday, and peeked through my fingers, watching her transform. The way I tore, they called it a starburst tear, if that helps. My best friend explains giving birth as a still just girl. And because of you, bearded, it does. We pass her son between us like communion bread, and I understand this. In the multiverse of my history, you are nothing more than a deserted midnight Main Street, no real where.
Hey, why don't you do another one too?
But that's that one. That's good. Okay. Let's see here. There's one I want to call. Okay. There's one I thought I had, but I don't. Okay. There's one here called Bait. Here's a girl hefted onto this barbed hook of a place. Here a girl impaled on a day. Her 14-year-old face raised as if toward the sun, pink around the writhe of her eyes. An earthworm is nothing but skin in the dirt through which it tunnels, her father tells her as he baits his hook. Don't fool yourself that he could feel like you. A girl is made of skin and the air through which she moves and all the things her daddy always said. If a hook can be a home, she has been waiting long for the cold plunge of metal through her guts, has believed it will feel something like love or a man. Her penned, riddling beneath him and his strength to provide, his calluses, his need to make nobody need. If a man can be a hook, a girl can be two homes, the dirt he holds and the dirt that buries him. A man is nothing but skin in the soil he calls home, her mother says, catching her glance at a man. Don't fool yourself that he can feel like you. A mother is nothing but skin and the fear through which she tunnels and the honesty to call it love. A daughter's young face raising toward a man, skin smooth in his rough light. Her daddy always said, go on, girl, fish or cut bait. Dinner won't wait forever. Small waves against the boat, brief pause of her held breath, brief panic of her hands, eyes.
Thanks, and that was Bait, a newer poem from Rachel Custer.
Bait.
Now, that's not the best transition, but one of the things when it comes to poetry I wanted to ask you about is at some point I saw you, or maybe you just said that Rattle is more of a narrative poetry-based publication, and so certain poems sort of fit more with Rattle than other poems, and you know, reading your book, rereading it again, because I read it like a year ago, but I reread it today, I was really struck by how different your poems from The Temple She Became are from the poems that we've published of yours in Rattle.
And
I, you know, after rereading again, I know exactly what you're talking about, which is your poems in that book are much more fragmentary.
Good.
They're sort of like, they feel to me like viewing a scene like out the car window as it drives by. Like there's these like fleeting little glimpses and you don't get the whole story. But you get these scenes and images and sort of the feelings of what's going on without the backstory. And can you talk about like that distinction for you and why, how does that happen? That you have some poems that are really sort of more narrative, I guess you could say, where you have the background and know the whole story, and other poems that are these like glimpses as you sort of drive past. What does that do?
Yeah. Well, so that's, I'm glad that you said that because that's a very fragmented is a very, very good way to describe what I meant. I don't always know the right, like the lingo, right?
Well, I'm just making it up as I go along. So, so I have
always
no idea
think
either.
Of like, yeah. So I do think that's good though. A fragmentary kind of a, the little scenes, right? This little images. And I like, I think that I try to do something different a lot because I get bored. And so I worry that if I'm getting bored, you know, someone else is getting, probably anybody reading is going to get bored. But also the poems that I wrote for The Temple She Became were about some very specific, very traumatic early events. And the memory of trauma for me, I mean, the memory of trauma, and what we know about trauma is that it's fragmented, right? It fragments. And so that was part of the form that I used and just kind of the way that those came because of the way that memory process, you know, you process those memories. And then I set out to try to do some more story type poems or even poems about kind of people or personas, you know, voices.
Yeah. It seems to me, it seems to me, I was thinking as we, you know, cause I talked, as I mentioned before, I talked to Paul E. Nelson the other or yesterday about, poetry, like as a spiritual practice for yourself rather than poetry as a, you know, something for an audience to appreciate and understand, you know, and if you're writing for this, like pure sense of trying to understand your own world better, in some sense, it doesn't matter what other people get out of what you're writing. And rereading your book today, I kind of got the sense that that's what you were doing, was focusing on your own spiritual journey, but not even caring if other people understood or got anything out of what you're writing. I don't. Is that something that you think about? Do you think about the audience as you're writing at all?
Well, I think then I didn't, right? Because that was, I mean, that book was written from over a decade, probably. And I think one thing that I didn't know then, and this sounds kind of ridiculous, but until I finished, until I went to back to college, I didn't really realize that there was a contemporary poetry scene or genre or being being written. I mean, I kind of thought when I was, I always wrote poetry. But I kind of thought that you had to just be brilliant, and then get into like the Norton Anthology or something when you died. I don't know. I thought, yeah. So I, you know, I kind of just wrote and I took classes in when I went to college, and realized that, you know, so then I got to read books and realize that there are people actually publishing poetry right now. But I never thought that I would be a person who could publish a book right away. Right. So I'm just writing. I was just writing out what I needed to work out at that time, which was a lot of really difficult kind of stuff that had from my life. And so it was just, yeah, it was just a way almost of me working through that.
Yeah. Yeah. So. That makes a lot of sense. That's how it felt rereading the book. Do you want to close out with one last poem, whatever you want?
Yes. Do you have a preferred?
No, just whatever you feel like. Let me see.
I think I'll do one called God Breathed. And I If you don't mind, I will describe. I will say a little bit about this
Yeah,
poem
please do.
first. Is
Yeah,
that
please do.
okay?
That's a part of the fun, actually.
Okay, so it's called God Breathed, and the reason that it's called that is because in Scripture, in Christianity, there's a concept about Scripture being inspired by God, and the word there, the word in the original language is God means God breathed. So Scripture that is canon, right, is seen as directly the breath, directly born on the breath of God, and that's important, I think. To it's an important thing to understand as far as my frame of mind. And then there's a Jewish rabbi who wrote a quote, it's kind of the what is that thing
Epigram?
called that you put underneath the title,
Yeah.
the epigram? Epigram. Okay. And his name is Ben Bag, I think that's how you pronounce it. I'm sorry to anybody if I didn't pronounce that right. And the quote is, "Turn it and turn it, for everything is in it." Right, and it's about Scripture and how, if you turn it and look at it from all different ways, that it's everything is there. Right, so that God breathed. Hell both here and anywhere but here. Well, both clear and anything but clear. Fear both well and desperately unwell. Here both hell and hotter fires than hell. Hell the smile that stays a beat too long. Smile a hell that plays the heat a song. Heat a trial that slays the fleet and strong. Fleet the wind that lays the wheat oblong. Earth the burn the farm sun plants and skin. Hell in turn the harm one chants within. Farm the land our soiled hands call home. Soiled the tanned and oiled lands all roam. Fall both season and a gate to death. Death both reason and abated breath. God both test that sends and where it sends. God both quest that ends and where it ends.
That was God Breathed.
Yes. God breathed.
Yeah, thanks so much.
God
Yeah,
breathed,
Rachel
yeah.
Custer. Oh, wait, what are you doing with your poems? Are you going to put together another book? Because you have, of the poems you sent me to share today, most of them are not published in a book. Do you have another book project coming up, or are you just writing poems and emailing to people?
I'm just writing poems. I mean, I'm not unwilling to publish a book, but the important thing to me right now is writing poems, enjoying poetry, sharing it with people. So, even with my book, I don't like to charge. If people want it, they can. I mean, I give out free PDFs or whatever, because the important thing about it is to share, right? It's the important thing about the art is to share it. And so, I mean, any of the poems, if people are interested in them, or I'm in a moment of just wanting to freely share them. I mean, I maybe will consider making a book sometime. I don't know.
Yeah, well,
I don't want to go through. I've been deplatformed so many times and had, my first book got canceled from the first publisher, and that was horrible to go through. And so I don't want to go through that again, to where I send it out and then have someone write an email to the publisher and it be pulled. It's just
Yeah,
too
yeah.
gut-wrenching.
Well, I hear you. And
So.
I really think I tell people all the time, I think self-publishing is what to do now for poetry because a small press, which is all you're going to get on anyway, can't really do much marketing and they don't really, there's not, so only so much they can
Right.
do. You kind of end up doing everything yourself. Even 10 years ago when my book came
Right.
out, I made the cover, I
Right.
made my own little tour and stuff like that. I did all my own marketing. That was with Red Hen Press, which is a good press.
Yeah.
And 10 years later, it's even worse than it was then. The financials just don't add up. The average poetry book sells
Yeah.
100 copies,
Yeah.
and so nobody can make money off it. So
Right.
they just can't have staff working on your poetry books anyway, unless you end up on Norton. But if you have a poetry book that everybody loves and people buy, then you'll be end up on Norton anyway. So I think
Right.
that poets should just self-publish. I don't see any reason
Right.
to do it differently. Print on demand. make, you know, take a bigger cut of the profits, and just, if you care about your poems and your craft and edit and proofread and design covers that are really good, I think you're better off that way. I know people, you know, who work at presses don't want to hear that, but I think that's just the case. It's an unfortunate case, but it's just the case now. So I hope you do that and put your books out, because there's a lot of people who really enjoy your poetry.
I will always let people have my poetry if they want to read it. Always.
Well, great. Well, thanks so much, Rachel, for joining us, and hope you know, come out with another book, and we'll
Thank
have you.
Thank you. I appreciate you
yeah,
having
yeah,
me.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. Good night.
Bye. Thanks, Tim. Good night.
Yeah, so that was Rachel Custer, author of the book, The Temple She Became, from Five Oaks Press, which you can pick up on Amazon.com still. That came out in 2017. Thanks so much to Rachel for being on the show tonight. Now this is the time for the prompt poems of the night, as we move into the open mic portion. If you would like to join in and call, talk about anything, talk about what we and Rachel were talking about. I really didn't mean to talk so much about social media and Rachel Custer's situation. I really wanted to focus on the poetry, but it kind of came up, and then we kept talking about it. So the show's going on longer than normally does. If you would like to join in on the open mic, though, anyway, you can give me a... Let's see, let me put this on screen. You know, the phone number is 818-850-7727. If you want to share a poem or just talk about what we were talking about, feel free to give me a call. You can also send me a chat message over Skype to Rattle Poetry, and I'll reply and let you know. And I'll give you a call back when the time is right. If you call and I can't answer at the moment, I'll give you a call back too. So just hang out by your phone. I think that's how we usually do it. Now, we always have a prompt. It's a new tradition. And the funny thing about the prompts is that they always end up being really relevant to my and Megan's personal life. Megan wrote these prompts back in December when we decided to start doing this. And we're just going down in order doing them. But like, we went to a museum in San Antonio the day it was like 3 a.m. art museum. And this week we went to a, what's it called? The... you know, miniature golfing with an arcade and stuff this week, just with the kids, because we wanted to get out while we still could. And so we ended up in an arcade. And the prompt for this week was President Trump goes to the arcade. And then there was a bonus suggestion, which we're always going to do. And this is to write a villanelle, which is a specific form. It's sort of like the French sonnet, you could say. It's a 19-line poem with certain lines repeating. You'll see coming up what they're like. If you wrote one and didn't send it in time, but want to give me a call over Skype or the phone, once again, the phone number is 818-850-7727, and the Skype address is Rattle Poetry, all one word. You can do that right now, and I will get to you. But I have a few people who sent, I think, three poets who sent poems in that we have. I think that's going to be the max. Like, I'll pick three every week, because we can't just keep going on reading poems about the same topic over and over again. But three is really fun. And then me and Megan each write a poem based on her prompts. So here's my poem. So the prompt again is President Trump goes to the arcade, and the bonus section is it should be a villanelle. And this is mine. As always, I guess it's become a tradition. I wrote it. I started writing at 5 p.m. and we go on the air at 6 p.m., so I have like 45 minutes maybe to write a poem. And this is my little villanelle. And I tried to, you know, I should say, before I read this, I should say the opinions expressed here do not reflect those of Rattle or the Rattle Foundation. These are my own personal opinions. Although, even saying that, I tried to be ambiguous. And I tried to write a poem. I thought it'd be fun to try to write a poem that either a Trump fan or a Trump hater... what's the word for somebody who doesn't like Donald Trump a lot? I mean, I don't want to say like a rational person or something. But somebody who doesn't like Donald Trump, a Trump opponent, could you say? Either way, I thought I tried to write a poem that either one could appreciate. And here's my little villanelle. This is when Trump visits the arcade. He always wins bigly. His scores are the best scores in whatever city. His ski ball's so pretty, so much smoother than yours. He always wins bigly. The ethics committee, those contemptible whores in whatever the city, even they must admit he wins shooter game wars, and he always wins bigly. For the kids, it's a pity, and they head for the doors in whatever the city. So don't you feel shitty as the ticket roll roars. He always wins bigly, whatever the city. That was my poem. Now, Megan's poem, she always writes hers on Thursdays. And so we've been sitting on this for a while. This is Megan's poem. Also, President Trump visits the arcade. And here you go with this. And also, I butchered her poem so badly last time that she, I insisted that she read it herself because I don't want to butcher everybody's poems. If you can include audio, I should say, when you submit these, if you use openmic@rattle.com, the email address to send your poem, send an audio file too. If you use Submittable on the open mic and you say prompt based on whatever, include an audio file too, then I don't have to butcher your poem for you and you can read it the way it should be read. So anyway, here is Megan's poem, President Trump Visits the Arcade, read by Megan. So that's not working. I don't know why that didn't work. I guess I'm going to have to butcher Megan's poem. Anyway, I'm sorry, Megan. I don't know what happened. We recorded this and it ended up blank. That doesn't make any sense. Anyway, here we go. This is...
Next week's prompt
so
is...
That one works. So we recorded her saying next week's prompt, but her Trump poem is silent. Okay. Well, as much as I didn't want to, I'm going to have to read her Trump poem. I don't know what happened. That makes zero sense. So here is President Trump Visits the Arcade by Megan. And she's the one picking these prompts, so kind of not fair. President Trump visits the arcade. He likes to take war for a spin, where neon lights blur every face. A bloodless kill is how you win. Put a soiled quarter in, a cartoon hero sweeps the race. He likes to take war for a spin. An inoffensive, neutered sin to gamble in this childish place. A bloodless kill is how you win. In this game, he has no skin, no risk in pixelated chase. He likes to take war for a spin. Give him tonic, hold the gin, up his sleeve a joker's ace. A bloodless kill is how you win. Losses, taken on the chin, when names are easy to erase. He likes to take war for a spin. A bloodless kill is how you win. There is Megan's poem, President Trump Visits the Arcade. We have three more poems, I think, to share with you tonight. Who is next? This is Sean Hines, who sent a poem a couple weeks ago. So here's a new Sean Hines poem. This is Sore Loser. Hopefully the audio will work for Sean. Let's see.
Hello, my name is Sean Hines. I attended Old Dominion University, studying English with an emphasis in creative writing. This poem is in response to this week's prompt about President Trump going to the arcade. It is a villanelle entitled Sore Loser. That's not the high score. That's fake news. No one's ever done better than me. No one can walk a mile in my shoes. It's a hoax. It's rigged. It's all a ruse. Pac-Man, Centipede, Galaga, all three. That's not the high score. That's fake news. It didn't save my game. There must be a loose fuse. I beat the high score. They all took a knee. No one can walk a mile in my shoes. I am the president. I never lose. Don't believe what you see. That's not the high score. That's fake news. I need a new challenge. What should I choose? It doesn't really matter personally. No one can walk a mile in my shoes. The one thing I know is you may be confused. 3 million more chose crooked Hillary, but that's not the high score. That's fake news. No one can walk a mile in my shoes.
That was Sean Hines reading his poem, Sore Loser, for the prompt for the week. Sean Hines was born in North Carolina and has lived most of his life in Virginia Beach, Virginia. He attended Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia, studying under great artists such as Tim Siebels and Sherry Reynolds, and is currently assembling multiple collections of poetry and working on a novel. Excellent villanelle. I wonder if we should have some kind of like who has the best. But I don't want to make everything a competition, but that was a pretty good villanelle. So thanks so much, Sean, for sharing that. Let's see. Next up, we have Kathy Gibbons. I'll read her bio first before she starts. Kathy Gibbons is a writer who hails from Houston. She prefers roller coasters to noisy arcades. Her words can be read in Barron Magazine, Poets Reading the News, Anti-Heroine Chic, Tuck Magazine, The Ekphrastic Review, Creative Nonfiction's Tiny Truths, and Ojal, which is that's the same magazine that published a bunch of Rachel Custer's poems. And this is her poem now. This is Blow All the Whistles, Ring All the Bells by Kathy Gibbons.
Hi, Tim and fellow Rattlers. My name's Kathy Gibbons, and I'm calling in tonight from Houston, Texas. I wrote this poem in response to tonight's prompt, President Trump Goes to the Arcade. Here we go, and it's called Blow All the Whistles, Ring All the Bells. The bling, the bling, the bling. The throne in his brain has gone gold. There's a gleam in his eye and a sheen on his skin as he strains when he lifts his mallet and pounds it down to whack a misfortunate mole. He ejects all the pinballs and sends them to holes and sneers as the bells ring out their refrains. The bling, the bling, the bling. The banks in his brain have gone gold. No thought in his mind, no toll on his soul. A king empty, bereft, as his chaos reigns. So he heaves his mallet and pounds it down to whack a misfortunate mole. He yanks on the slot's arm to anchor his bankroll and bellows as fruits align once again. Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. The banks in his brain have gone gold. At the shooting gallery, his gun has a goal in its sights, sitting ducks to shatter on aim. Then he strangles his mallet and pounds it back down to whack a misfortunate mole. This is all he has dreamed of or ever been told as he counts shiny coins and tallies his gains. The bling, the bling, the bling. The throne in his brain has gone gold. His imperial hammer is brandished once more to whack a misfortunate mole.
And that was Kathy Gibbons' poem. Blow all the whistles, ring all the bells. I found this was a lot of fun to write that poem 2 hours ago now. If you're watching at home, this has been my experience reading Poets Respond poems submissions every Saturday morning for the last 3.5 years, really more than that, 4.5 years, just Trump. So I've kind of heard it all. It was kind of fun to write my own, though, for the first time. So it's been a fun prompt. We have one more. This is Corrine O'Reilly. And she didn't include audio, so I'll read it for her. And the only bio I have is she lives in Southern California. This is Corrine O'Reilly. The Tower Arcade. I am the leader of the land of the free. The aides quickly nod as Melania sighed. No one wins more tickets than me. The caravan stops on the way to D.C. The beast door opens. He steps outside. I am the leader of the land of the free. His unmistakable outline against the marquee. Fake gold doors open. He looks around with pride. No one wins more tickets than me. Now zeros in on a game with familiar filigree. Some kids are playing. He shoves them aside. I am the leader of the land of the free. He misses all the targets. Tickets yielded, 3. His face is red with anger. This game is lied. No one wins more tickets than me. The manager is summoned. The game opened with a key. Trump grabs all the tickets, pockets brimming wide. I am the leader of the land of the free. No one wins more tickets than me. Another great sonnet, that by Corrine O'Reilly. Thanks so much for sharing that. Now, if you want to do a prompt for next week, once again, all you do is use Submittable to submit them, or you can send them by email to openmic@rattle.com. Include audio if you can, that I can have you read it instead of having me butcher the reading. Next week's poem, next week's prompt is An Addiction to Soap Operas. And the suggestion, which you do not have to do, but there'll always be a sort of a prompt to get your mind rolling and then a suggestion. And the suggestion is to have it be an epigram, just meaning short and witty. So some kind of witty short poem about an addiction to soap operas. If you want to write a longer poem, though, feel free. We just want to spark writing more poems for people. And even if you don't want to submit what you wrote, just please do participate because it's so much fun. I feel like the whole reason that we do Rattle is because poetry is an enriching experience for all our lives. We want everybody in the world to be a poet. I think the world would be a much better place if everybody participated in poetry. And, we understand the world through words and through language. And if we can articulate our thoughts, there's really, Emily Dickinson said that I know it's a poem when the top of my head is taken off. And I really believe, I've said before, but I really believe that that sense of the top of our head being taken off is that sort of integration of our two hemispheres, where the holistic understanding of the world maps onto our direct understanding of the world. And it's a really important thing to be doing. It makes our lives all better if we do it. So hope you do participate. Once again, next week's prompt is An Addiction to Soap Operas. And the suggestion is to make it an epigram, short and witty. So I hope you do that. Let me do one more check to make sure no one's called yet. I didn't miss any phone calls. So that is the show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please do click the like button. Share it wherever you are watching or listening to this. And click 5 stars. Just tell people about this show if you enjoyed it, because it's a lot of fun, I think, to meet a poem in their living room every Tuesday night. I really enjoy it. We publish about 300 poets a year, and getting to see them in person is actually really fun. I enjoy it. I loved meeting Rachel Custer for the first time. Hope you did too. And we'll meet a new poet every Tuesday night. So click the like button, click the bell, subscribe, give it 5 stars, share it on Facebook, wherever you're watching this. Please do that. Now, next week, we have Lola Haskins on her new book, Asylum, which I think is from Pitt Press, although I have to look it up again. And Lola Haskins has appeared in several issues of Rattle, and she's a Florida-based poet, and we just love Lola Haskins, so we're really looking forward to that show, and I will see you then next week. In the meantime, I hope you have a good week and a good rest of your night, and I'll see you soon. Good night.